Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never change anything.
We'll be right back. Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I saw coming along. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and beg, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is, these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tonnes of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from SolarNow retailers to get their businesses going.
SolarNow is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better, and so I get more customers.
All right, today, depends on what you guys want to talk about, the lead-off topic here is migrant communities versus victimhood communities, migrant communities versus the victimhood community, and we can talk about planned villages or planned communities, production villages, intentional communities, and, of course, migrant communities versus victimhood communities. Between April and this month of this year, 2022, it's reported that 9,000 migrants have been bused to Washington, D.C., a place that was once called Chocolate City. Of course, it's no longer Chocolate City. And the mayor there has called for a ban while she can juggle things around and set things up. Chicago, many migrants who have showed up in Chicago, the city of Chicago has... they're busing people to, or sending people to the suburbs surrounding Chicago or other areas of Illinois. Now, I'm sure there's some other areas of the country that this is happening as well. My question is, okay, will the migrant communities, because they're in the country, okay. They're coming here. This is their land of opportunity. And well, what do you think's going to happen? I've got my thoughts, but what do you think's going to happen? I give an example, and he was on here Tuesday of this week, Delmar America. He stated. Now, Delmar America goes, he takes a walk up in Chicago, and he goes to this particular McDonald's in a black neighborhood, and one day he got there, matter of fact, more than one day, but on this one particular day, he got there, and the door to the lobby was closed. Now, they were serving people through the drive-thru, but the door through the drive, I mean, the main lobby of McDonald's where people walk in and order what they want and can sit down and eat and converse and all that, that was closed. And it happened right after payday. And something like that, because, you know, some people, when they're ready to spend their money and they're hungry, all right, and Burger King's right down the street or Subway's across the street, or they'll go to another place and patronize. So now that the migrant community, like I say, in the D.C. area, that's 9,000 people. Now, you got to take for granted, let's say, let's divide this up, 9,000. So you got, let's see how that, you got 3,000 children. And you got, let's say, another, out of the 6,000 left, you got adults and teens that are ready to work. But I'm going to boil it down to this. Let's just say out of the 9,000, 3,000. 3,000 ready to work. 3,000 ready to, they're ready to take their job at McDonald's in the morning. They're ready to, you know what? They are going to show up at work after payday. What are your thoughts on it? 619-768-2945. Migrant communities, and they've got networks here already. They got networks here already. And we're going to hear, you know what, in a matter of, 6 to 12 to definitely 18 months, less than 2 years, we're going to hear success stories about some of these migrants that have come over here with nothing but the clothes on their back and get housing, started businesses. And you'll probably hear about, well, you'll hear maybe a handful of millionaire stories out of it. Meanwhile, the victimhood community is going to be bellyaching. 619-768-2945. What are your thoughts? Migrant communities warfare versus the victimhood community.
Can we make just one big choir? Now, you know, in choirs, we got to rock.
Thank you.
got open mic, but we got a start-off topic, migrant communities versus the victimhood community. You have migrants that are being bussed into various cities here in the United States, and what's your thoughts on it? 619-768-2945. And if nobody doesn't want to talk about that or anything else, you know, we can kick off early today. It is well, Friday, the start of the weekend. Yesterday we left off at, church camps? So if you guys want to talk about that, we have five of those coming out. Okay, it's kind of quiet out there. So, okay, I'm going to play an oldie but goodie, and if nobody comes out of hiding, then what I'll do is I'll just kick off early for today. But anyway, what we're not, let's go with Solar Cabin. You guys got anything you want to talk about, call within the next 7 minutes.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land, okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat. I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Okay, well, we have 7 minutes, no takers. All right, well, we paid for the time, so we're going to run through this old stuff. If you got anything you want to talk about, just raise your hand. And particularly migrant communities versus the victimhood community.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
3,000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。一点钟准时安排送料。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. UPA started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but UPA wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. UPA's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of UPA's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost UPA a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to UPA. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
Okay, enough of that. Today, let me put it out there at least one more time. We can do open mic, but something I picked up, and it's been in the news lately, and I want to see how many cities this is in. But today's title is Migrant Communities versus the Victimhood Community. I'll let you define what the victimhood community or communities are. Okay. But the migrant communities versus the victimhood communities. And let me give an example. A couple of them, actually. Once again, and I mentioned this earlier in today's live stream, from April of this year to this month, there have been 9,000 migrants bused to Washington, D.C., so much so that the mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, she put a temporary ban on so they can get organized up there to handle the influx. That's 9,000 people. That's for Washington, D.C. proper. We're not even talking about the suburbs. Arlington, Virginia, Fairfax County, Prince George's County, Anne Arundel County, Loudoun County in Virginia, Prince George's County. That's just D.C. 9,000. Okay. So you got those, you got the suburban counties that are around D.C. Let's count this out. You got Prince George's County, Maryland. These are counties that border Washington, D.C., or in the area. Prince George's County, Maryland, Montgomery County, Maryland. You got Arlington, Virginia. You got Fairfax, Virginia. You got Loudoun County, Virginia. You have Anne Arundel County, Maryland. Okay, those are the counties that a lot of people that live in those counties work in D.C. All right. Now, let's add on D.C., so that's number. So we're talking about seven general communities. Now D.C., from April of this year, once again, from April of this year to this month, 9,000 immigrants. Migrants. That's the proper name. All right. So multiply, let's say 9,000. Let's just go around the beltway here. 9,000 times 7. That's 63,000 people. In Chicago, when they get to Chicago, they're sending them out to the suburbs surrounding Chicago. Let me give you a third one here. Now, this is a possible scenario, and this is why I named today's podcast Migrant Communities versus the Victimhood Community. And I'll let you define the victimhood community, because people will probably have a different visual, a different optic on who is in the victimhood community. Here's the true scenario. All right, this past Tuesday, we had Delmar on up in Chicago. And Delmar, he typically takes a walk to, you know, a McDonald's within walking distance of what he's seen in Chicago. You know, he's got a little routine. Does his walk, goes in there, orders, you know, coffee or whatever. And he conducts business there too. You know, so he won't, because he works remotely. He does a lot of things. So one morning when he walked there, the door to the lobby, you know, people go in and go up to the counter and order and then sit down and eat their meal right there. And meet up with people. It was locked, closed. Although the drive-thru window was open. All right. Now, long story short, and this is a McDonald's that happens to be in a black neighborhood, which happens, well, at least the morning shift a week ago was mostly black. I don't know what it is now, but black. So payday happened, and there wasn't enough people that came into that particular franchise where they can open up the lobby and where they can, you know, serve customers. All right, they just had a skeleton staff that can basically cook some food and then handle the drive-through. And in that amount of time, because when people are hungry and people have money, if there's a Burger King or a Subway or some other place to eat across the street, next door, whatever, that money is going to move to wherever their hunger tells them they need to go. Now, with, like I say, 9,000, we said 63,000, there are probably 63,000 immigrants between April of this year and this month that have made their way to what they call the DMV, the District, District Maryland and Virginia. And they're going to take those jobs that, you know, with people, you know what, that don't show up the day after payday. Those jobs, some of those jobs will be filled. Now, this is just my prediction. It's going to be filled by some of these migrants. Because they will work, they will get paid, and they're coming to work the day after they get paid. And then the demographics within the employees of various, in this case, McDonald's restaurants in black neighborhoods, that's going to change. And then somebody will be screaming, they're taking our jobs. That's the victimhood cry. No, they didn't take your jobs. You gave up your job when you got paid and decided, you know what, I got some money in my pocket. I don't feel like going to work the next day. I'm going to call in sick or call in late or just won't pick up the phone at all. Now, I said you can paint the demographically, you can pick the victimhood crown any way you want to. I just gave you a Chicago example in a black neighborhood. Now, the same thing can happen in Boise, Idaho, where you have all-white staff McDonald's. People get paid, and they don't come in on the next day. All white folks. But white or black, they're crying victimhood when they can't even get a job at McDonald's. And it, matter of fact, the way things are now, and it's been this way for some time, particularly what city you're in. I remember back in, it was like the early, mid-80s. And I had a student in the D.C. school system, and she came to school disappointed. She was a young mother, teenage mother, going to school, and she wanted to get a job. So she went on to good old reliable McDonald's, because a lot of teenagers get jobs at McDonald's to this day. But she couldn't get a job at McDonald's. Why? She didn't know how to speak Spanish. They were hiring. This is back in the mid-80s now. She wasn't bilingual. So the migrants that are coming into Chicago and D.C. and other places, they're bilingual. Some are polyglots. They speak multiple languages. You got them coming in from Haiti, because you got Haitians that, you know, their success strategy of coming in through Miami, that didn't really work so well for them, so they've gone to Cuba. They've gone to Mexico, and then from Mexico, they're coming to the United States. So Haitians can speak French, and they're picking up Spanish, you know, because they've spent some time in Mexico. So they're coming in, they can speak three languages, bare minimum. Let me see if I can. Number of migrants. So what is, well, here's another thing. Washington, D.C., that used to be called Chocolate City, it went from 70% black, now it's 43% and shrinking. And once again, you got, and that, you know what, that's 9,000 migrants that the powers that be know about. God knows how many are there coming in on a daily under the radar. See if I can find some. Okay. Hold it. Okay. I'm reading here more than 44.9 immigrants lived in the United States as of 2019. The historical numeric high since the census records have been kept. In 2019, immigrants comprised 13.7% of the U.S. total population. That figure remains short of the record high of 14.8 in 1890. All right. How many immigrants came to the U.S. in 2020? Let me see. Okay, then this goes back to, all right, those figures go back a little bit too far. Let's see what, okay, by the end of 2021, 1.5 people arrived at the border and crossed for the first time. That's in 2021, last year. Border control agents carried out over a million expulsions and deportations, including a mass expulsion of Haitians. But once again, they're getting in, though. They're getting in, and they're not being turned away now. Okay, but now 44.9 immigrants as of 2019. Let me see. Now, what is, I got to get the statistics, number of African Americans in the USA. Let's see what that number is. All right, there are 41.6 as of 2020, 41,600,000 African Americans in the United States. Now, here's another article here. The African immigrant population in the U.S. steadily climbs. Let's check that out. Oh, hold on. You know what? Oh, I want to compare a number first. So there are There are more immigrants in this country, 44.9, as of 2019, than African Americans that were born here. Claude Anderson, that's why I play that Claude Anderson piece every day. All right, African immigrant population in the U.S. steadily climbs. Now, this is African immigrants, not African American, not black folk. African immigrants make up a small share of the nation's immigrant population, but their overall numbers are growing, roughly doubling every decade since 1970, according to the new Pew Research Center analysis for the U.S. Census Bureau data. There were 2,100,000 African immigrants. Oh, Jesus, what? I got to watch my dog. I got two dogs around here. Anyway, living in the United States from 881,000 in 2000. And here's the breakdown, 327,000 Nigeria, 222,000 Ethiopia, then Egypt, then Ghana, then Kenya, then from you, it's quite a few countries here. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. All right, 21 African countries all have immigrants in this country. And every last one of them, from Uganda to Togo to Algeria, Zimbabwe to Nigeria, Morocco, Liberia, Cameroon, Sierra Leone, Cape Verde, Sudan, in Eritrea, Egypt, every last one of them has a solid multiple social networks here in the United States, where if a person wants to get into school, it's done. If a person wants to get into housing, it's done. If they want to start a business, it's done. If they need a job, it's done. And, well, maybe I missed that day in class, but I haven't heard of any of these groups marching or protesting. I'm not even going to go into the reparations part. Anyway, but what are your thoughts? The migrant communities versus the victimhood community. Now, you also have people, once again, that live in, because these people are all over. They're in Montana. You got immigrants that are going to Montana. You got them going to the Dakotas. You got them going to Washington State. You have them going to Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine. You know, and then you're going to have people in those places. You got them going to Kentucky. And then you're going to have people, white victims, white people that are white that have the victimhood mindset, you're going to have them saying they're taking our jobs. That's why a lot of these white supremacist organizations or white brotherhood organizations form in the first place, because they feel that people that don't look like them, don't have this same religion or practice this same religion or whatnot, they feel that, you know, you're taking our jobs. Matter of fact, lynching. When lynching was going on in this country, particularly in most of the blacks that were lynched, were prominent or wealthy blacks, they felt, you know what, they're taking our share of the wealth. So they killed them. They have a victimhood attitude. So victimhood attitude doesn't have one specific color. That's all I'm saying. Okay, so you have 44.9 million immigrants as of 2019. And let me get, let's see, black population. I'm just double checking here. Okay, the black population of the United States is 13.4%. Okay, and okay, the black, all right, here's the breakdown. 57.8% of this country is white. 18.7% of the population is Hispanic. 12.4% is black, although we're going to take the higher number as 13.4%, and 6% Asian. All right, and okay. Let's see. All right. Well, the black immigrant, excuse me, the immigrant population of the United States now outpaces the African American population of the United States. And I predict Now, it's not doomsday for anybody, but within 12 to 18 months, we'll be under 2 years, we're going to hear immigrant success stories. People that crossed that border with nothing but the clothes on their back, who have obtained their American dream. That's one of the primary reasons why I'm not big, me personally, on reparations. Because this reparations discussion has been going on for over 100 years. Over 100, a century. But you have people that have entered into the United States of April of this year. I guarantee you by April of 2023, and April will be here before you know it, because we're about, you know, fall is knocking at the door right now. It'll be getting cold soon. The furnaces will be popping on if they haven't popped off in some areas of the northern part of the United States already. And then before you know it, it'll be spring. April will be here. April of 2023 is less than a year away. And I guarantee you, by April 2023, we're going to hear some immigrant success stories. People that came with the clothes off, just their clothes on their back. And not only got a job, not only got a house, but have become millionaires. Meanwhile, and there's nothing wrong with this, you got people trying to do whatever they're going to do. Now, you know, it's not so much wanting reparations as, all right, hold it. It's been 100-plus years. Probably over 150 years. Well, I'm putting it at 100. At least 100-plus years. We got to switch up. If you're going to get, if you want, you got to figure out a new strategy. And then you got to look at, all right, hold it. What's the end goal? What's your end game if you did get reparations? Now, if you got reparations, if you want reparations in the form of a check, okay, all right, which is your end game? Let's say you want an end game that you want to receive $1 million check from the government. Okay, I'm not knocking that. But who's got a better way, who's got a better strategy to get to an end game where they're going to get $1 million check? Those who wait on the government, or those who come into the country with nothing but the clothes on their back and take advantage of the opportunities that are here and make their millions that way. Another prediction I'm putting out there, in there will be, like, these immigrants that will come from Africa. Okay, I'm looking at the list. You're going to hear success. They're going to be success stories in from each and every one of these countries within 12 to 18 months. Maybe not millionaire stories, but success stories nonetheless. Definitely Nigeria, you're going to hear some success stories. So, once again, your thoughts on it. Once again, and the way I'm looking at the victimhood community does not have one specific color. Because I can take you to plenty of places all over the United States where they have organized groups that have been around, Aryan Brotherhood, KKK, another groups that they feel that they're not getting their fair share of the pie because of other people that don't look like them. Now, some are going to look like them, but they're not from here. Because in addition to Haitian success stories that are on the make right now and other Latin American countries, those success stories, you're going to have people, as a matter of fact, they're already over here, a lot of them, Ukraine. There are going to be some Ukraine people that came from Ukraine, came through a war-torn country, and they're going to snap up opportunity. Just like that nine friends, let's elevate that to 90,000 friends. Well, you know, let's not go there. There'll be 90,000 success stories, but then there'll be a solid 9,000 stories on, because the whole thing about when I play the nine friends thing, fixing up the house like it's brand new overnight, is that the people who it was that these people that didn't live in that neighborhood originally, they saw the opportunity there and then took advantage of the opportunity. And that's what's going to happen. That is not going to happen. That is what's happening. And what's happening now, you have people coming in from Ukraine. You have people coming in from Haiti. You have people coming in from what I named, about 20 countries in Africa. They're here right now. They're here right now. And they're taking advantage of opportunities that the average American doesn't see. And they don't have any trust fund. Some are white, some are black, some are Asian. Anyway, but they're not crying victim. They got on a different set of glasses. So, anyway, let's see what's going on in Chicago. Immigrants, you know what? I'm gonna pick. You see, immigrants. I'm gonna pick. Charlotte, North Carolina. Okay, immigration, Charlotte, North Carolina. Let's see what happened in the Carolinas. What's happening there? How many immigrants are in Charlotte, North Carolina? Let's see. Foreign-born persons. From 2016 to 2020, it's 17.2%. Let's see. They have an immigration court in North Carolina. That means if they got an immigration court in Charlotte, North Carolina, that means there's a lot of immigrants in Charlotte, North Carolina, and its metro area. Let's see. Here's something on here. Is Charlotte immigrant friendly? Charlotte City Council voted unanimously on Monday to pass an immigrant compact, becoming the first city in the United States, the first city government in the U.S. to adopt this statement in support of the city's immigrants. Charlotte, North Carolina becomes the first city in the U.S. Yes, all right, I read that already. How many undocumented immigrants are in North Carolina? Well, according to this, it says more than 200,000. Oh, wait a minute. I got to get, that's a different number, all right? More than 200,000 U.S. citizens in North Carolina. Oh, okay. More than 200,000 U.S. citizens in North Carolina live with at least one family member who is undocumented. So that's at least 200,000. Now, that's in North Carolina alone. And they said at least one. They got social capital. But Charlotte, North Carolina has a, they got an immigration court. So and that's a profit center for the local government. Anytime they set up a court. You know what, let's look up another city. Let's go to Iowa. That's like in the middle of the United States. Immigration in Iowa. That's one of the barometers that you want, you know, people are running for president. 6% of Iowa residents are immigrants. 6%. That's in Iowa. All right, here's a question. Why do immigrants come to Iowa? Let's see. All right, they had cheap land prices at first. What immigrants settled in Iowa? These are basically European ones. All right, Des Moines, Iowa, and I've been there a handful of times. The number of foreign-born residents living in the metro area of Des Moines, Iowa, increased by 40,000 in 2010 to about 60,000 people in 2019. One of the highest rates, and that's in Iowa. Hey, man, it gets real cold in the wintertime. All right, well, no, excuse me. Now, here's another one. This is a February 23rd, 2022 this year. Foreign-born population hits a record number of 46,600,000 in January of this year. Now, that's more than the black population of the United States. Well, I don't know about a group strategy, but if you don't have an individual strategy, I think you need one. Anyway, your take on migrant communities versus the victimhood community. And once again, the victimhood community is optically whatever you say it is, because you got white folks that are playing the victim card too. These foreigners are taking our jobs. These foreigners are taking up the available affordable housing. These are white folks in Lexington, Kentucky, in Dubuque, Iowa, and, you know, in Bismarck, North Dakota, places like that, lily white places. You got the victimhood crowd there, so I'm not picking on black folks. I'm just some people. The immigrants are here to stay, point blank. It's a capitalistic country, and unless you can come up with a better mousetrap, they ain't going nowhere. All right, let's go to the phone lines. I've been running my mouth so much. 407, your mic is open.
Grand day, grand rising, good afternoon. This is Bianca with Soul Purpose Healing on Sunday night, and
Health and Wellbeing Friday Morning Female Solution. And you're absolutely right, L.A. The population of the United States, I was thinking about everything you were saying. The population of the United States is full of foreign-speaking, foreign languages right now, right? So we got people from all over the world coming to the United States. They speak foreign. So, okay, think about this. Capitalism. People in this country are everywhere on social media trying to make money. Okay, capitalism is huge in the United States. So what are employers looking for? They're looking for people who speak another language so they can sell their product to everybody and anybody who's in this country, whether they speak English or not. So I was listening to Michael Beckwith. You know who Michael Beckwith is?
Yeah, I do. New Thought Minister.
He was, oh my goodness, it was such a powerful teaching. I was just so excited. I was on cloud nine after this man. This was an hour and a half on a YouTube show with Michael, another Michael. So it's two Michaels, just high vibration. And the one thing I wrote down to take note on is that he said we, talking to his audience, we are specialized people. We're not special, but we're specialized people, meaning unique individuals will specialize in their excellence. You, for instance, are specializing in building smaller houses, all the tools and all the things you know that you've learned up to now. You're specializing in that. I'm specializing in health and well-being because my father put that in me from the time I was born. I'm specializing in athletics and taking care of your body and being a teacher, a coach like my dad was. So we have to, as you said, minorities, especially black people, they don't have the mind that they need to specialize in whatever it is they're good at, whatever they can become excellent in. People from other countries, number one, they specialize in their language. If they know how to speak more than one language, that's a specialty in this country. You're going to get hired over somebody who only speaks one language, English, because everywhere I go, most of the people who are serving me speak more than one language, except in Publix grocery store. I see more people in Publix who've been there for 20, 30 years. I talked to some of the cashiers there. I'm like, how long have you been here? Oh, I've been working with Publix for 20 years. I'm like, really? And so they don't speak Spanish, but they speak English, and they got seniority, and they doing what they do in a way that I guess they feel special at. They can ring up them groceries fast. They can smile at you and all that. And I smile back. I make them smile now. I go to the grocery store. I'm the specialist in making people smile and saying their name. I feel like everybody these days needs a smile and a kind word. So I'm thinking what you're saying, we need to, black people, white, no matter who you are, you need to understand what are you good at? What's your specialty? And then become excellent in that. Because if you don't speak another language, you can't focus on specializing in language, in diverse languages. And that's what employers are looking for.
Yeah, people need to learn Spanish. And in some cases, they need to learn Russian or Ukrainian because the Ukrainians are here and their numbers
and
are growing.
Portuguese. We got more Brazilians Florida now than you ever can imagine. Everywhere I go, I know what Portuguese sounds like. It has a certain rhythm to it, or over Spanish. I can be listening to a conversation in another language and I can tell what language they're speaking. And Portuguese is very unique and distinct. So we got a lot of Portuguese.
The person who sold me internet service. Matter of fact, the service I'm on right now, with internet and landline phone. He's black, but his wife, who was riding around with him, Portuguese. She's from Brazil.
Yeah.
And
so
the lady that bought your tiny house is Portuguese.
Right. Brazil.
I mean, Brazilian,
Brazil.
But speaks Portuguese.
Yeah. Brazil, exactly.
You're Brazil,
so,
right.
Some of them speak three languages. So
right.
We're way behind. This is a good thing, and on some level it's a good thing because the United States is way behind in our skills to communicate with the global population. And most people in Europe have learned English a long time ago. That's the second language, probably.
Oh, yeah.
But
we're so
proud and arrogant in the United States. Well, I only need to speak English. And anybody who comes here, they need to speak English. Well, you're going to be left behind with that attitude. I'm a senior citizen. I don't need to speak Spanish, but I do want to learn more words in Spanish because my grandchildren have a Spanish-speaking mother. So it depends on where you are in your evolution of
Download the app to your phone, Duolingo. I get up between 1 and 2 o'clock every morning, and I take 2, 3, 4, and then short lessons. I'm working on Spanish right now. I've been working on Spanish for 144 consecutive days. And I just go to my phone with that app Duolingo, and that's how I'm picking it up.
And for me, it's just another way to communicate with my grandchildren and learn things from them, as well as them learning things from me. So we have this interchange of things they're learning that I don't know that they can teach me, like Spanish. Their mother is teaching them Spanish. They hear it all the time. They don't like to speak it, but they hear it all the time. So they're going to know what Spanish sounds like, and now it's a matter of taking a formal lesson in Spanish for them to be able to speak it. But they understand most of it because their mother's been speaking it to them all their life and their grandmother on her side. So we got to catch up. Americans need to catch up, either learn some languages or specialize in something that you can market to other people. And if you need to make some money, that's how it works in this country now.
Yeah, that's true. I noticed one thing, like you might see an American, doesn't matter what color, that let's say they're at the traffic stoplight or the busy traffic stoplight. I mean, and they're hustling. You know, they're asking people, you know, could you give me a quarter? Could you give me a dollar? What have you? Now, what I've noticed, a lot of the Latinos do. Is they don't do that. Some might do it, but the ones that I've observed is they might be selling you oranges, fruit,
flowers. Yeah.
Yeah. Or on a hot day, they'll sell you cold water.
Yeah, they're exchanging.
So they're enterprising.
And talking about victimhood, my dad had a course he took in college called the Psychology of Adjustment. And so he was never had a victim mind all his life. Even though he grew up in poverty and Jim Crow South, he was segregated Army unit. Oh, he never had a victim mind because he took this class that impacted him for the rest of his life. And people who have a victim mind, they
now, what's the name of that class?
Psychology of Adjustments. It's actually something on YouTube. You can find videos on the Psychology of Adjustments on YouTube.
Psychology of Adjustment.
So you don't go walking around, poor me, I'm a victim, I need reparations, I need this, I need that. You know, like it's like all these Spanish-speaking, Portuguese-speaking people are flooding the country. What do I owe? Poor me, I need reparations because I'm a poor little English-speaking minority.
They're not all these immigrants, and there's plenty of them. And I'm talking about the ones that have been that are coming. They're not marching and protesting.
No.
I mean, you know, at best, they'll march to McDonald's and get their job application.
Right. But my point is, it's the spoiled English-speaking Americans that are crying victim, 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 and the Americans who are conscious and see the light of things are making an adjustment and saying, I better go take a Spanish class. I better go take a Portuguese class. If I'm going to specialize in something and market my product to every person in this country, no matter what language they speak.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're right. Yeah, we're going to have to adjust that way on a critical mass level basis. Language learning, that's one of the skills that we're going to have to pick up on a mass level. Or if we don't, as Claude Anderson says, we'll be left behind. All right, we're going to take our next caller. We're going to take a 2-minute break, hit the head, get water, get coffee. We'll be right back.
Take up a whole lot of time, and he doesn't get a chance to speak. So I'll wait.
He's not on the He's not present for today.
You sure?
Unless he's hiding somewhere, but he's not on my switchboard.
I always want him to come in first because you know how Sister be out and I take up a lot of his time. So
you got his time. So he's not on the board. He's not on the board.
Okay, I just want to be fair. Brother Elliot, before I get into what I need to say, I need you to answer three questions for me.
Okay.
If you will.
Question one.
I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to imagine that you're looking at a bunch of people that is crime victim with their hands out and dependent on the government. I want you to tell me what color they are.
You know what? Now, this might sound crazy, but I'm going to answer it honestly. The first question, the first thing that popped in my mind was some white folks from West Virginia and Lexington, Kentucky.
Next question.
Okay. Because I've seen that state of West Virginia, and I've seen that in Flint, Michigan. Next question.
So the victims with the hand out and depending on the government, you say they are white folks.
No, they're not the only ones. You said the first person that...
No,
people.
I just asked you the question. The first thing
that popped in my mind on a visual side, because I had my eyes closed, is I saw a white hand. I remember this when I was in Flint, Michigan, and I saw this white girl walking across the street in Flint, Michigan, barefoot, dirty black feet, walking into some store. I'll never forget it. Matter of fact, a friend of mine that was with me, they were over from Europe, and they said I wouldn't want to die in Flint.
Next question, what is the definition for reparations?
That's a good question. Matter of fact, you know what? Let me go look it up right now. I'm glad you brought it up.
You've been using for the whole time I've been listening to you.
Okay, the legal definition, that's what I go by, of reparations. I'm going to read it verbatim. Okay, I'm getting the legal definition, not the
Webster definition.
Yeah, no. And then... All right. To answer that question, all right, what is the difference between restitution and reparations, and what are the top five types of reparations? So let's go with the difference between restitution and reparations. Restitution is the restoring of the right to the rightful owner what has been lost or taken away. Period. All right. That's the definition of restitution. The definition of reparation is restoring to a good condition of something that has been damaged. Now, I read those two definitions word for word, verbatim, for the legal definition of reparations.
Okay, that's your answer.
Well, I read it. It's not, I read it verbatim, yeah.
Okay, but you agree with that. You agree with that. Those definitions.
I
right?
agree with those definitions. Yes.
Next question. What is a trust?
Wait a minute. One more thing, BZ. They talk about the five different types of reparations. Now this is new to me. Cessation was spelled with a C, and assurance of non-repetition. Restitution and reparation, compensation, satisfaction, and rehabilitation. And that's under the five types of reparations. And I've never heard about the five types of reparations and not of the reparation talks that I've heard or even participated in. So I think we need to bring up those distinctions.
Okay, good. So, you're satisfied with those definitions?
I am.
Okay. Next question. What is a trust fund?
How can I? Okay, you suppose. An account, let's say an account set up, an account or asset set up to benefit other people. That's my definition of it.
Okay. I'm satisfied with your definitions because those are the words that you have used. And you, when you come in and you give your spiel on things, is that called a monologue? Or what is it called?
Are you talking about with Claude Anderson?
No, no. At the beginning when you started running down the difference between immigrants and victimhood. Is that a monologue?
This is the title of today's podcast, Immigrant Communities versus the Victimhood Community. And my definition of victimhood community is anybody who claims victimhood, but it's not based on solely color, because plenty of examples of, like, the Aryan Nation, the White Brotherhood, these groups claim, the KKK, the Proud Boys, these groups claim victimhood, that they're not getting their fair share of the American pie because of Jewish people, black people, immigrants. We're letting them in, and we're not getting our fair share anymore. So the optics of a victim could be any color.
Well, you know what? In the past, that hasn't always been the case with you and a lot of conservatives. And the thing is, I can go back in the archives and I can prove it, and I can look at the millions of hours that I've looked at black conservatives have gone on shows and talked about black folks always complaining and being the victim and blaming the white man for all of their problems. Now, look, with that being said, I just wanted to clarify what I've been hearing over the years. I've never heard what you just said being said on those millions of hours that I've been listening. And I've been looking at talk shows and reading and everything else. But now, look, I'm going to get on with your subject. There is no difference between migrants and victimhood. They're one and the same. And the thing is, all of those immigrants that's coming over here, whether they're coming by plane or boat or they're coming across the Rio Grande, all of them have been described as victims. That's why they're coming to America. And they're given special visas because they're victims of wars and coups and just governments just coming in and mistreating them. Now, do you disagree with that?
They have been classified as victims.
That's why they're coming here, because they're victims. The newspaper says
they're classified that way. They're legally looked at that way. Well, all I'm saying is that those immigrants, let's say we can call them victims. Those victims are going to turn into victors in a matter of months.
That is not true.
You don't think so?
I know so. And I gave you some statistics. I've been sending you statistics. And I've been talking for the last I don't know how long. In fact, I gave you the amount of money that these evacuees, which are victims, Afghan evacuees, which are victims. I gave you the tons of government aid and entitlement programs that they're throwing on those people and money to put in their pockets and housing and education. And the thing is, you know what? Those are reparations. You tell black folks you get your reparations by going out and doing such and such, which we have, you know, getting your own jobs, building your own businesses, buying your own land, and everything else. And look, we have been doing that. And we have not been complaining about people taking our jobs because, hell, ain't nobody offered us a job. But now I've given you that, and I ask you, where's the outcry yesterday about all of this money that's being given And all of these programs that's being developed for these Afghan victims. And the reason why they're doing it is because they're getting reparations. Because
you're saying that the Ukrainians, the immigrants that are coming to the country, that they're getting reparations
Afghan
from our government in a form of these, you know, what you just said, you know, the payouts, the programs and all that.
And housing and food and food stamps and Medicaid and the money that
You know what? Now, according to the legal definition of reparations, what you said would fit them.
That's right.
But now, with that said, now a lot of the people, ADOS crowd, let's go with ADOS, African Descendants of Slaves, that crowd,
we're proud now, right?
They're trying to
we're
get
proud.
Money out of the government, but because, you know, the way you just put this, I mean, the example that you gave of reparations, that is
no,
reparations.
No, you gave it.
All right, well, that's what's happening. That's true. They don't call it that, but that's what it is.
Legally, the way you described it, the 200 non-NGOs, non-government organizations that has fallen in line to go in and help these people that are really getting funding through grants by the government, and the government is repairing the damage. Those people have been damaged because of the wars in their countries, and the thing is, we're trying to repair the damage according to the definition that you gave.
Yeah, which is reparations is restoring to good condition of something that has been damaged, and there's a period on that.
Thank you. So now, you know, we'll refer to as a crowd, but those are referred to as victims and their migrants and their people. And the deal is this. I have not heard the white liberals and the black liberals and the black conservatives and the black Republicans say a word. In fact, Congress is passing legislation now to increase the aid for these people coming in. And I have not heard you complain or talk, but they're just handing out. They're just coming here to lean on the government, and they're coming here with their hands out. And the thing is, they come here to get a check. And that's what they come here for, by the way. They come here to get a check.
Touche. Touche. I just never thought about it, but you're right. According to the legal definition of reparations, they're getting a check. And like I said, they're not calling it reparations, but in reality, that's what it is. It is, according to what I'm reading right now, is restoring to good condition something, and in their case, they're running from a war torn area that helps restore them.
Of no fault of their own. But now here's the thing. But when it's black folks, it's reparations. With black folks, you need to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. All you're doing is waiting on the government. That's what we hear.
Hold it now. Since we're going, all right, you got me on that one. But, all right, man, let's look at what's over here already. There's Section 8. There are all kinds of safety nets for women with children. There's WIC. I mean, there's all kinds of government programs over here already.
They're getting it. And look, the thing is, they're just stepping off the plane.
Can't we call that reparations, too?
I said, hey, look, those people just stepping off the plane.
Well, that's true.
They're just stepping off the plane. Look, they didn't come here. They didn't go through 400 years of slavery. They didn't go through Jim Crow. They haven't been discriminated against. And the thing is, they haven't been lynched. And the thing is, we built this country, and when we asked for repair the damage, back when the Civil War ended, they told us to go to hell. In fact, they locked up Keller House when she gave them a plan to go ahead on to repair the damage. They locked her behind up. So now the thing is, these people didn't even have to ask for it. They just get stepped off the plane, and there we go. In fact, the State Department is coming out and saying, look, we got to get these people housing, and they're going to house them. And the first thing you say is, you know, black folks, they ain't got no land and all of this other crap. But now let me go a little step further, because I don't want to pick on the Afghans. I want to cover the whole thing.
There's a lot of them.
Oh, they're coming over here every day across the Rio Grande. And the thing is, I read an article where it is costing the United States government $113 billion a year for illegal immigrants coming across the Rio Grande in any other way that they can come over here. I haven't heard you or your black conservative buddies or your white conservative buddies or the black liberals or the black Democrats say a darn word about all of that money being poured out there. And look, they got sanctuary cities. And look, they're housing them in hotels. They're going ahead on and getting them Section 8 and finding housing for them. And I haven't heard you say a word. You know, I haven't heard you say that in proud. I haven't heard you say.
Viada's got a comment.
Yeah, let her come in, because I got something to tell Viada. I thought about it the other day, and God rest her soul, I love Viada. The only reason I call is because I want to hear her voice, but go ahead.
You know, Beaver, you got comedian talent.
I got
okay,
jokes.
Here's my thought. The last 3 years, let's not talk about 400 years, because I wasn't damaged by 400 years. I'm sorry, 400 years, I heard you mention so many things that happened in the past that I want to bring us up a little more to the present. Let's just go with the last 3 years. This Twilight Zone that the whole global family has been on, because these elite minds, these psychopathic, war-mongering, fear-mongering minds have been trying to control the hell out of everybody. So I would just suggest that we look at just the last 3 years. Let's not go back to 400. We all know the damage that was done to our ancestors, forefathers, with the 400 years of slavery, employment, whatever. Let's just say that in the last 3 years, it's been revealed that just about every system operating, the political system, the medical system, the educational system, the media especially, the entertainment, and not let's not leave out the religious system, all of them are corrupt. So we're looking at a new paradigm that needs to be created. So why can't we just focus on creating something different than the last 3 years that was revealed to us being totally corrupt? And all the countries of the planet on Earth have been involved in this corrupt. The governments have all been involved in revealing their corruptive nature. So let's not go back past 3 years. Let's just about the last 3 years was enough corruption evidence for us to know, at least for me, that we got to get rid of this paradigm we've been in with all these corrupt systems and create something new. And that's what, by the psychology of adjustment, we've been all abused in the last 3 years with this controlling, fear-mongering system. Can we move forward now and stop focusing on the past?
The Jews have a saying, never again. Never again, because you know why? Because they want their children and they want the people to be on alert. Hey, look, we got screwed one time, but we ain't going to let it happen again. And every year they bring up the Holocaust. I mean, we see it on TV. They got Holocaust museums all over this country, and they always make sure that when their kids, before those kids graduate from bar mitzvahs, they let them know their history and their suffering. Because they know that when you learn about that, whenever you see signs of that happening again, you're on guard. So now the thing is, they ask black folks to forget all of the stuff we've been through. Hey, all the lynching, all of the Jim Crow, all of the slavery and all of the police shootings today and all of the, what's his name, George Zimmerman's and everything else. Forget about that. You know, that was in the past. No, the past is right now the present and the future. And the thing is, Sister Viola, you know, you ought to be shaming yourself. Because this corrupt government, well, look, let me say this, because the government has been very good to your people. Y'all got your own casinos. You can check every 3 months from those casinos, and you got your own land. And the thing is, y'all getting royalties from the governments on your land and everything else. So you don't have anything to worry about. This corrupt government has taken care of you and your people.
That's not my family history. Nope, sorry, not my family history.
You're a Native American. You're a Native American. You're getting all of that.
The government didn't give my family nothing. My family took the land and built on it and raised families. That's what my family did. Took the
land. You're entitled to it. You're entitled to it if you want it. You just don't want it. I mean, it's just like L.A. said. If they give reparations, he ain't going to take it because he don't want it. So you're entitled to it. So if you want it, you can get it.
That's what you're missing. I already have reparations. I don't need to beg for anything. I have my reparations. Those people
exactly.
are still begging. They
exactly.
don't have what they need, obviously.
Exactly, because you're a Native American, so y'all got y'all reparations. We ain't got nothing. But I'm just
who are you talking about? We. My dad lived 95 years. He never complained or begged for no reparations. What are you talking about?
He didn't have to. He's a Native American.
My father's side is Native American. My father's side was probably more from Africa, but he wasn't begging for nothing. He was totally self-taking responsibility for everything that happened in his life, good and bad. That's what the problem is.
So you're not entitled to the revenue that's coming from those consumers. Is that what you're telling me?
Title to Social Security because I've invested money in that system for all my life. That's what I'm entitled to.
I ask you a question, but you are in your tribe has got casinos. If you want to, you can go and claim that money.
Well,
or your children can
not every tribe has casinos.
I was never
maybe.
Into no casinos. My tribe was into land ownership. That's what they have. They have land ownership.
Not every tribe has a casino or a golf course or accommodations.
Well,
she just
said
that her
tribe
got land, so with that being the case. But anyway, Brother L.A., I just wanted to bring out the hypocrisy. And the thing is, these people come over here with their hand out, they laying on the government, and then you give me a success story that they come over here and they become you know what? Black folks can become millionaires, too. We got all of that kind of damn help. I mean, every time we look around, ain't nobody trying to help us. They're trying to take from us. And look, I'm going to give you this. If it comes down to a black person applying for a job and a Hispanic person applying for a job that looks half-ass white, guess who's going to get the damn job? I'm just telling you like it is. Bilingual or not. And that's the way it works. I mean, that's the way it works. And look, you know what? I don't blame them. And look, when a Hispanic gets a job, guess what? They look out for their own. The next thing you know, the whole operation is speaking Spanish. Or either the whole Russian group that gets a job, they bring in their Russian people to get that damn job. So now, my thing is this here. We've always pulled ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
Right.
If we ever, we know if we ask for something, we ain't going to get it. Because the first thing they say is, look, if you got a problem like that, you don't solve it by throwing money at it. You know, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. All you do is whine. All you do is depend on the government. Ask the government for everything. But I'm just showing you that all of these things that we've been accused of, it's a lie. Because everybody else gets handouts around this joint. white women, LGBTQ, whatever what the hell they are, the alphabets, you name it. But when it comes to black folks, we get criticized. And when you said you, the first thing you saw with the hands out and depending on the government, you know what, Brother L.A., I'm going to take your word for it, but the average black conservative, when they close their eyes and you ask them that question, the first thing they see is a black person.
Probably most people would.
A single female, a black single female, head of household with one children on each side and a baby in their arms. That's who they see.
Well, they got a lot of single white women with kids too.
Yeah, but they don't
see
them.
Matter of fact, there are more of them than black ones.
Of course it is, but you don't see them. Whenever you see unemployment,
well, yeah, the
whenever you see somebody
news doesn't do that, we're in Florida, so once you get outside of Miami, Fort Lauderdale, through in West Palm Beach, Tampa, St. Pete, Orlando, Tallahassee, and Jacksonville, Florida's got 67 counties. Most of those counties are occupied by mostly rural white folks.
Of course. And there's a whole lot of poor rural white folks. And I give you this, Brother L.A., and I'm going to just, next time you get a chance, you know you got to watch yourself. You travel around in these cities, you can find them there too. I can take you to Baltimore, and I can show you a whole section of poor white folk. Right down the street from those cities.
Over there by John Hopkins? That area? That's
not only John Hopkins, but you turn down Washington Street.
Fells Point? So over there by Fells Point?
Fells Point's been gentrified.
Over there by the Ann Arbor?
Yeah, they done took that over. Rich white folks got that. But
right.
You turn down there by the stadiums and you go down Washington Street, you'll see a whole bunch of them. I can take you in D.C. and show you some. You haven't been there in a while, but I can show you some.
Well, D.C., I
can show you
some. My neighborhood in D.C. done turned white and Asian and everything else.
I can take you in Oxon Hill. I can take you in Riverdale. I can take you all over the area and show you some poor white folks and poor Hispanic. And you go in the grocery store starting about just before 6 o'clock, and they got them baskets filled with food, and the EBT cards are coming out like nobody's business. So now you ain't got to go to rural white folks. I can show you they're all over. But the thing is, whenever you look at these TV shows, the first thing you see is a bunch of poor black folk.
Well, I never looked at these people coming over here as getting reparations, but the way you put it, they are getting a check. Their primary motivation to come to this country is to get a check. And where they came from, their governments don't cut checks like we cut checks in this country.
I beg to differ. Through the foreign, the foreign aid, Afghanistan is getting a whole lot of billions of dollars.
Are they giving that out to Afghanis in Afghanistan now?
It doesn't matter. The government's getting it.
The government of Afghanistan? That's what you're talking about.
That's right. I'll send you the article. Look, Brother L.A., you know when I say something, I'll send you articles backing my stuff up.
Concept here that the Ukrainians and all these immigrants, they're, according to the legal definition of reparations, they are getting reparations without 3 years or even 400 years of lynching, Jim Crow, discrimination, none of it. So you made a very good argument on that. Because according to the legal definition of reparations, that check, that aid that they get from the government, be it a check, a place to stay, medical treatment, all of that is meant to repair them, and that is part of the legal definition of reparations.
Of course, but they don't call it that.
They don't call it that, but that's what it is.
With them. you know, hey, they're victims.
Okay, see, well, like now with that said,
go ahead.
I ain't got nowhere to go with.
I'll wait.
Because with George Floyd, his family got compensated. But that's an isolated situation.
I'm talking about
with the people that are coming on, the 9,000 people that went into D.C. and God knows, well, it's a lot of people. But all of them have been getting aid. Matter of fact, I have a friend of mine. I've had him on here before. And he gets his tenants from an organization called, Interfaith Works. And essentially, that organization takes in immigrants.
And
pay their rent.
Since you mentioned, I guess
that's reparations.
Oh, and let me give you this. It is. And look, let me give you this. These NGOs, like the Hebrew Immigration, ever what the heck it is.
Mm-hmm.
See, all of these NGOs is rushing to help these people. But now here's what they do. And I was trying to send it to you this morning. What happened is they work as nonprofits, right?
Yeah.
The one in New Haven is going to house 9,000 of these people in New Haven, Connecticut. But guess what? They're steering them towards realtors that's going to find them rental property, and they're going to put them on Section 8. So what these NGOs do, they're being staffed and funded by the government and contributions from corporations, but mostly the government. Now, I'm going to send you the percentage that the government is giving them funding through grants.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they steer them to their people in business so that they can go in and help their ethnic groups' businesses to gain profit. So now this guy, he's got an NGO, and his whole thing is about immigration. And look, by the way, you said it yesterday. They're lobbying for these people to come over here. And what they do is they give them housing and everything else. And the reason why they do that, because, hey, look, I'm looking out for my buddies. So, and look, with the food stamps, hey, look, I'm putting you over here in a white area away from them niggas, and I'm going to let you spend your EBT cards over here with people that's all these corporations and supermarkets that's already in business. So everybody's getting a hand now. And I was wondering why these Jews were so excited about getting those immigrants over there in Brooklyn. Now I know. Because, see, that organization, that Hebrew organization that helps immigrants, they're global. And the thing is, that's how they get their money and jobs for their people. And also they look out for Jewish interests to go in and put them where they have to spend money with Jewish businesses. So everybody's getting some out of this thing. And the thing is, you know, black folks get lambasted. So it's a money-making machine. And the thing is, hey, black folks, we pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. And then when we do get something, they want to go in and figure out a way to take it. If you look at all of the business districts that was in these cities, run a freeway right through it. And black folks haven't survived that yet. Look at what they were trying to do there in Atlanta. Since these black folks have started creating businesses, what's this guy's name? I can't think of this rapper's name. That whole strip down there, they're trying to go in and do away with that strip because black folks have started building up Atlanta. Mm. And they're trying to put all of these...
Killer Mike, might be his name.
Killer Mike. That's right, Killer Mike.
Killer.
I think I sent you the article.
Right.
In a video
right.
where they'll try.
Beasley, we're going to wrap it up because I got a hunger pain that's serious here. You got the last word. I'm going to catch you on that those church camps. You argued your point well today, so thank you.